The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from National Geographic and the Washington Post. But before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we'll be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. Today on Armchair Traveler, we continue reading from Indigenous Futures. It's a series of special reports featured in the July 2024 issue of National Geographic. And before I continue, I need to inject here a disclaimer. In a previous episode of Armchair Traveler, I misstated saying it was the May 2024 issue, and that is incorrect. It is in the July 2024 issue of National Geographic that this series is presented. And as the editors note on the cover, from conservation to culture, how those who came first are charting a new tomorrow. That's what the essence of the stories are. And today we're going to read an article about stewardship. It's titled Our Fire, written by Siobhan Singleton. As the introductory page caption reads, like Aboriginal women before her, Siobhan Singleton helps manage control burns, small, cool fires that spare the canopy to shape the land. So now, let's go to Our Fire. The earliest memory I have of biribiri, or fire, comes from when I was 6 years old. A soft, smoky smell lingers in from the rain. I'm sitting on the old couch in an open house made of corrugated iron sheets and wood, listening to my babysitter tell stories. I watch her cook over a bush-made stove built from the same iron and timber as the house, the same timber I still hear crackling today. As Indigenous peoples of the wet tropics of Queensland World Heritage Site, on the vast coast of northern Australia, we practice cultural fire management to keep our spirits, soils, and vegetation intact. It is living knowledge, a relationship that we practice on country. We walk and observe the changes with our old people and youth. Biribiri is our medicine for both Bulma and our homelands and our Gulbul, our sea country. It cleanses one's spirits when we walk and practice fire. We yarn about the different arrangements in plant structures, from leaf layers to grass connectivity, through to the root systems, soils, and country types. We read country and align the indicators from the soil to the sky to tell us the right timing. Walls were never meant to separate us from our original home. As an Arukanji woman and knowledge holder, I face challenges not only with climate change as we experience rapidly changing conditions and major weather events, but also with the Australian government, which remains slow to acknowledge and accept our land and cultural rights. Being a woman in the fire space brings challenges from all directions. I am told by men within our communities that women do not belong among biribiri, that traditionally we've never practiced the burns. We have always had a role in relationship with biribiri. The women have great knowledge of plants. Knowing how and when to gather them is like knowing how to weave them into the baskets we use to collect foods. It is a story in itself. For many generations, biribiri has been a part of everyday living for us. I remember being with the aunties sitting in the country by the beach as we waited for the food to cook on biribiri. After a day of gathering food, we sat close to biribiri for warmth while the wind wrapped around us. When visiting country, we always speak to our ancestors. You learn to listen to the sounds of country and our old people, hearing their experiences and how things have changed in their time. Elders teach me to keep the knowledge and connection alive for the next generation. And if we are to keep the knowledge living on in our kin, we will need patience, just as we will need patience to keep our cultural practices alive. It's just like seeing a plant for the first time and learning all you can about it, connecting with it, knowing its texture and smell. This I have learned from my elders, and this I will carry on. Well, our next article is written by Renzo Aroni Sulca. Now, his article focuses on a Peruvian culture where, quote, young indigenous musicians have transformed hip-hop into an expression of their language and culture, unquote, This article is titled the Quechua Sound, Quechua. I want to make sure I pronounce this right. There's a lot of Spanish and Peruvian words, I should say, more specifically, coming up in this article, so please bear with me, okay, as we enjoy the Quechua sound. All right, we begin. It's a sunny January in Jaluaca, a city near the banks of Lake Titicaca in the high plains of southern Peru. Thousands of indigenous Kuan and Aymara people have gathered in the town's main square to commemorate the massacre of 18 political protesters and bystanders by government security forces 1 year ago. Among them is a man on a black horse, decked out in a black jacket, a broad-brimmed black hat, and mid-calf and gold boots. He's dressed to evoke the country's most iconic revolutionary figure, Tupac Amaru II, the indigenous Tucaca, our chief, who led a rebellion against the Spanish Empire and became a symbol for resistance in the Andes. The man is known as Quesur, and Quechua plus sur in Spanish means this south, and he's there to express solidarity with the victims. He's also there to rap. From horseback, Quesur performs his song, Proceres, or Heroes. It's a hip-hop beat pulsing through the crowd. Many recognize him from YouTube and identify with his lyrics. Manan, Wanachupachu, Iliataka, Antipaki, he shouts in Quechua. By killing, you will not defeat my people, is what it translates in English. At 20, Quesur, whose name is Yersin Randi Huanco Canaza, is among a growing generation of young musicians making hip-hop with a specifically indigenous voice. Like many of them, he draws from multiple cultures and traditions, Spanish and Quechua-speaking, global and local, ancient and modern, and with his fellow artists. He's creating something entirely new, a soundtrack for indigenous youth eager to reclaim their Andean roots and language. Embracing Quechua so publicly would have once been unthinkable in Peru, although some 8 million to 10 million people speak the language in the Andean countries and beyond, and 26% of Peru's population identifies as indigenous. Many native Quechua speakers have felt ashamed of our language and traditions because of ongoing racism. Mainstream Peruvian culture tends to romanticize Inca civilization while denigrating its living descendants as backward, especially when they try to assert their political rights. Since the mid-20th century, many Quechuan immigrants to the cities have identified as mestizo, or mixed race, rather than indigenous. Often, they didn't teach Quechua to their children. During the 1980 to 2000 conflict between the Maoist Shining Path and the Peruvian government, some 70,000 people were killed and more than 500,000 displaced. Most of them were rural, poor, and Quechua-speaking, the targets of both sides. Inspired partly by Upcha, or Ashes, a Quechua singing blues rock band formed in the early 1990s amid the violence in Ayacucho, the epicenter of the conflict, Andean young people are reclaiming their heritage. Already connected to the wider world through diasporic networks and social media, they are reimagining what it's like to be modern and indigenous. Hip-hop, with its oral tradition, communal spirit, and culture of resistance, is a natural vehicle for reviving the Quechua language and Andean culture. Renata Flores, one of Quechua rap's biggest stars, says it's our ancestors had come up with ways to express their feelings, similar to what freestyle rap is today. She's thinking especially of Harawi, pre-Columbian music poetry, traditionally sung in a high nasal pitch without instruments, that voices the soul of Ranakuna, the Andean people. The 23-year-old wearing round glasses, wide-legged jeans, and a fleece jacket told me her music, which mixes hip-hop and electronic effects with Andean instruments, serves the same purpose as Harari, chronicling the daily life of our people. The new genre also incorporates Andean spiritual practices. In the song Fiesta Pac for the Party, Luis Loyosa, Ramos 24, a.k.a. Wari Wilka, or Wari's grandson, asked permission from the Apu, a mountain deity with a living spirit, to initiate the chaku, or chaku ritual, during which wild vicuñas are rounded up and sheared. Apukunawan, Palamuni, Kakachacha, Akukukuspa, he sings, and it translates, I talk to the Apu chewing my cocoa leaf. And then there's an effort by some rappers to open the historically male-dominated genre to everyone, to challenge both Quechuan and hip-hop culture. At a 50th anniversary celebration of hip-hop in Ayacucho, Flores performed songs from her 2021 album, Escun, or Nine, which places Andean women at the center of Peru's history. At a smaller concert called Iliapache, Lightning Day, derived from Iliapa, the Inca deity of lightning, in downtown Cusco, Celinda Enriquez, 27, rapped, Manya Hachanichu Nuka Imacha Kani Womachu Karuchu Nakaka Kani Kasuka Kawaseta Kawaseta Munane from her song Miram Machata, or Tomboy. And it translates, I don't know if I'm a man or woman. I'm happy. I want to, and I want to live. Afterward, I heard from men in the crowd, surprised by how much they enjoyed Enriquez's energetic beats. That Quechuan rap, a genre that balances at the place where language and culture in past and present meet. After his performance in Juliaca, Quesura cries, The bloodshed will never be forgotten. The crowd roars back to him, greeting him with hugs and handshakes when he dismounts from his horse. His music, in a traditional language with a modern rhythm, has resonated deeply, and no wonder. Hip-hop, he says, is a way of thinking and living Quechua. Well, we'll have more articles from the July 2024 special issue of National Geographic in future episodes of our Unfair Traveler, and we'll have, from what I can gather, based on the work we've been doing, that probably will continue through September, so lots more to come. Now, is your plane safe from a tornado? Boy, does that question raise some frightening pictures, huh? And it is certainly an interesting one, as it is the headline for our next article, written by reporters Hannah Sampson, Sophia Andrade, and Matthew Capucci. It was published in the July 17, 2024 issue of the Washington Post. They included a video in the online version showing plane passengers waiting out a severe storm as it moved over Chicago O'Hare International Airport on July 15th. Now, keep in mind, this is one of the busiest airports in the world. You can imagine what the people were thinking when all this took place. Now, let's read the article. The message appeared on social media channels late Monday night. Severe weather is imminent at O'Hare International Airport. The National Weather Service issued tornado warnings. Wind gusts roared at 75 miles per hour. Federal Aviation Administration workers briefly evacuated areas at the airport, including the control tower. Officials in Chicago said Tuesday, that was July 16th, that the severe weather hit O'Hare and Midway International Airports around 9:20 p.m. local time. Both airports engaged their safety plans, requiring travelers and workers to seek shelter away from windows into underground locations. From the tarmac, several people who reported they were sitting on planes during the storms asked, "What about us?" Travelers took to social media to describe waiting on board at O'Hare while aircraft rocked in the wind, listening to storm alerts blare from their phones. Similar scenes unfolded at Chicago Midway. We sit here in a tin can with wings, wrote one ex-user, posting a video showing rain streaming down a window and lightning flashing. The flight attendants went on from calmly telling us to get off to screaming, hurry, get off now, while the plane shook intensely. Scariest moment of our lives, but so grateful we are safe. And that little excerpt is from a ex-posting. On TikTok, a user posted a video from a basement area at O'Hare and wrote that her flight actually aborted before a flight attendant told everyone to get out due to a tornado. I was expecting the plane to just be torn apart in half at some point, said Justin Smolensky, who was stuck on a Spirit Airlines plane. That's what he told the Washington Post. When it wasn't, he decided that either planes are built really well or we were very lucky. The National Weather Service would later confirm 11 tornadoes were in the Chicago forecast area during the storm, but planned to continue investigating potential damage paths on Wednesday, July 17th, to identify additional sites, which they did, by the way. Tornado protocol for airports. Because of their aerodynamic designs, aircraft are easy to loft if air flows over the wings quickly enough. If wind speeds reach, say, 90 or 100 miles per hour, you'll start seeing commercial aircraft moved or smaller aircraft thrown. And that's just for straight-line winds. Tornadoes, meanwhile, bring their own lift with them. They are the vortices of powerful upward suction. Even a lower-end tornado like a high-end EF1 with 100-mile-per-hour winds could flip aircraft. And a significant tornado with 120-mile-an-hour winds could throw them, especially considering a tornado's rotating or changing winds. If a tornado hit a fully loaded passenger aircraft, a mass casualty event could ensue. The majority of tornado fatalities stem from head injuries and blunt force trauma, which could result if a plane were thrown. It wasn't clear why passengers on Monday night had been loaded onto planes and sent out onto the tarmac ahead of the line of severe storms. Chicago aviation officials directed questions about aircraft movements to the FAA. That agency referred questions about why passengers were boarded to airlines. Once flyers were out on the tarmac, aviation experts say, that's where they had to stay for their own safety. A tornado striking a plane could be disastrous, but so could leaving the shelter of the aircraft. In a situation like this, the safest option is for customers and crews to stay in the aircraft and for our teams to stay indoors, said Charles Hobart in an email. He's a United Airlines spokesman. He said that the carrier works to operate safely and efficiently ahead of a storm hitting, but adjusting immediate plans too far ahead of an impact could disrupt customers' travel plans, he added. We rely on our safety procedures to ensure we are making the right decisions, operate when we can, and clearly pause when we can't, Hobart wrote. Other carriers contacted by the Washington Post, including American and Spirit, did not explain when asked about their decisions to board passengers before the Monday evening storms hit. Denver International Airport, located in an area that has seen dozens of tornadoes in the past 50 years, said in an email that operation teams would not send people out to aircraft with stair trucks and buses during a tornado warning. Airlines make decisions about how they're going to operate their planes, the airport's statement said. If an airplane is boarding or deplaning during an event, the plan is for passengers and flight crew to deplane immediately and go to shelter, the statement said. Mike McCormick, an assistant professor at Embry-Riddle Aeronautical University with more than three decades of experience at the FAA, said in an interview that once lightning is spotted, ramp activity stops at the airport. That would make returning to the gate not a practical alternative, he said. Doug Moss, a retired airline pilot, aviation instructor, and safety consultant, said in an email that ramp workers are needed for a plane to back out from a gate or park at one. He said he's been in that situation many times. We were just about ready to push back, and we got a call from ops that all the ramp workers were ordered inside, he wrote. Therefore, we just had to sit there until the thunderstorm and lightning passed. Leaving a plane via stairs or a jet bridge could be risky due to wind or lightning, Kathleen Bangs, a former pilot and spokeswoman for the flight tracking site FlightAware, said in an email. Chris Cooper, an adjunct professor at the University of North Dakota's Aviation Department, said airlines will make the call whether to delay or cancel a flight due to approaching weather, but sometimes the flight might be boarded and ready to go when weather suddenly worsens. At an airport with limited space, there may not be anywhere to go. You certainly are not going to fly right into the weather, said Cooper, who is also an airline pilot. McCormick and Cooper both said that planes can withstand high winds on the ground. Moving a plane in bad weather could also be dangerous because of reduced visibility. McCormick said the risk is generally going to be greater if you try to move versus waiting it out. No one at either Chicago airport was injured Monday, according to the Chicago Department of Aviation. Staffers found minor damage to the outside of some O'Hare facilities, but did not immediately spot damage at Midway. American Airlines said in a statement that employees worked swiftly to return aircraft to the gate once ground operations resumed at O'Hare following the storm-related pause. The statement said American works with Chicago aviation officials and the FAA to closely monitor airport and airfield conditions and inclement weather. After the all-clear was given and the FAA resumed its staffing, airlines, including United, were able to resume their operation and safely move aircraft, Hobart wrote. Our staff and crew do their best to always ensure everyone's safety. After workers cleared debris from the airfields, operations started shortly after 10:30 p.m. Monday. Normal FAA operations resumed just after 11 p.m. The Chicago Air Route Traffic Control Center assumed the airspace during the evacuation, the agency said. FAA, which routes planes away from bad weather, briefly paused flights into O'Hare midway on Monday night, and that was again July 15th. According to FlightAware, there were 786 delays and 132 cancellations at O'Hare and 214 delays and 71 cancellations at Midway on Monday. Past tornadoes and close calls. Over the years, dangerous weather, including tornadoes and tropical storm-level winds, have swept by and even through airports. The National Weather Service warns that tornadoes are capable of completely destroying well-made structures, uprooting trees, and hurling objects through the air like deadly missiles. In the early morning hours of March 3, 2020, tornadoes plowed through parts of Nashville and hit John C. Toone Airport, a sister facility to Nashville International that caters to smaller regional corporate and private planes. It caused nearly $100 million in infrastructure damage, but that estimated cost from the airport didn't include 90 aircraft that were destroyed. A 2011 tornado at St. Louis Lambert International Airport tore off part of a roof of a concourse, sent people scrambling for shelter and restrooms, and pushed planes away from jet bridges, CNN reported. One passenger reported that the plane she was on shook violently and experienced air pressure changes. After Oklahoma City officials issued a tornado warning in May 2015, two arriving Delta planes were stranded on the tarmac at the Will Rogers World Airport. Ground crews fled to an underground tunnel for safety, unintentionally leaving the passengers on board. About 15 minutes later, according to local reports, help arrived and the travelers were escorted to a shelter. In July 2023, a funnel alighted near Chicago O'Hare. The airlines canceled nearly 170 flights and delayed 500 takeoffs, according to FlightAware. Inside the airport, video from that evening showed passengers cramming into a concourse for safety. In late May of this year, powerful storms with winds gusting up to 80 miles an hour pushed an American Airlines plane parked at Dallas-Fort Worth International Airport. One long night. At O'Hare on Monday night, again July 15th, Smolensky and his family were looking forward to returning home to San Diego when they found themselves trapped in the plane after boarding a leg to Las Vegas. We got on the plane, taxied out into the runway, and we stopped, and we waited, and we waited, and we waited some more, he said. And while we're waiting, it started to rain. It started to thunder. Soon afterward, he and the rest of the flight received emergency broadcast alerts on their phones warning of possible tornadoes in the area. Though the pilot spoke over the loudspeaker to tell the passengers not to worry about the alerts, it's just a little rain, Smolensky remembered him saying the father of young kids could feel the plane shaking. As the storm raged, he said his kids were absolutely panicking. The wait on the tarmac ended up stretching to 4 hours, Smolensky said. By the time the plane took off from O'Hare and landed in Las Vegas, it was late that night, and the family had missed their connecting flight. Without a hotel voucher, they slept in the airport until finding an early morning flight to San Diego, with another connection to Sacramento and arriving home 12 hours later than anticipated. It was brutal, Smolensky said, calling the whole ordeal absolutely a nightmare. He said there was one final indignity. On top of it all, spirits like, yeah, we lost your bags. Whew. Well, writer Andrea Sachs explains that bleisure, buddy moon, and gamping are now part of the dictionary of new travel trends. Now, her article appeared in the February 29, 2024 issue of the Washington Post. And we're going to give you a sampling, so get ready to learn some new travel language, okay? Remember when we just took a vacation, or if we were feeling European, we went on a holiday? Well, these days, those terms seem quaint, like Old English. The travel industry has created a newfangled language to describe different types of trips. The phrases are a mashup of words or a combination of ideas. A few of the newly coined expressions have slipped into our vernacular, such as staycation and volunteerism. Several, however, catch in our throat like hairballs. To help you decode the jargon, we created a glossary of terms currently kicked around. Some are worthy of adopting, but others should fade away like Tomcat and Brazzolina. Oh my, here we go. Bleisure, and that's spelled B-L-E-I-S-U-R. It's an adjective, they say, a hybrid trip that blends business and pleasure, Brooks Brothers suits and board shorts. Bleisure travelers typically tack on vacation days after their meetings wrap up or incorporate activities they can't put on their expense report, like surfing lessons and tequila tastings. And workcation is another word you may want to remember. We'll try to get to that one before time runs out. Next, we have the buddy moon, which is considered a noun. And when your work wife, husband, siblings, college roommates, and the hilarious guy you sat next to on the flight to Cancun join you on your honeymoon. The not just for honey's moon is a natural extension of the destination wedding. And then we have the coolcation. Yes, coolcation, another noun. That's spelled C-O-O-L-C-A-T-I-O-N. In response to record high temperatures and heat waves, planning a vacation in a colder climate where you will more likely shiver than sweat. And used in a sentence, they say, while their friends overheated in Europe this summer, Rick and Raquel gamely bundled up on their coolcation in Goose Bay, Canada. Then we have destination dupes. Yep. Alternatives to locations that are notoriously overcrowded, overpriced, or overrun with influencers and bloggers. The dupes are more fraternal than identical twins. Then we have divercation. Yep, that's a noun, divercation, a newly single person's holiday that marks a recent decoupling, the B-side to their honeymoon, if you will. Then we have day tripping, considered a verb, a booze-free vacation, even during Bacchanalian travel periods. Now, similar to sober travel. Then we have edu-vacation. Edu-vacation. Now, learning a new subject, language, or skill while on holiday without the stressful pop quizzes and term papers. Then we have the family moon. Now, a honeymoon with kids in tow. His, hers, theirs. Then we have a friendcation. Now, I've heard this one before. A trip with friends that's similar to a bachelor or bachelorette party, but without the cringy activities. And then we have gamping, and that's basically camping in a garden or backyard instead of traditional campground sites. Campers might pay the host a nominal fee or perform a service in exchange for their hospitality, such as mowing the lawn, weeding the flower bed. You get the picture. Then we have gig tripping, the next generation of deadheads, music fans who drop a ton of cash to travel to concert venues around the world to see their favorite artists perform live. Then the other words are mini-moon, a bite-sized honeymoon that's short, and then procrastipacking, mentally packing for a trip but not actually putting any clothes or toiletries in the suitcase. Oh, my goodness. We'll have to do some more of those later for you, but that's pretty much, you get the idea, right? So stay up on your travel lexicon, my friends. And that closes out today's journey on Armchair Traveler. Hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be with us again next week. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service, and I remind you that the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. Now, if you have any comments or questions, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.